Faith Strong Today presents WikiGod with Mark Grollo. Hear new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe to the podcast at faithstrongtoday.com.
Well, hey friends, this is WikiGod, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And I'm your host, Mark Grollo, and this is the uncut Faith Strong Today edition of the show. So let's wiki God today, because I don't know all the stuff there is to think about God. I'm pretty sure you don't. Some days we feel like we do, but maybe you haven't heard everything. And so that's why we talk to each other. We wiki each other's stories. We listen to someone else wiki their thoughts about God, and maybe that has implications for what we're going to think, how we're going to live our lives, what we can connect up to. And so this week we are wikiing God with Josh Brake. Josh has been a pastor for 10 years and 10 plus years now, I think, and he's the founder, along with his wife, of Katoa, katoa.org. So I caught up with him in his office last winter as he was suffering from a horrendous cold, you know, typical Toronto thing, but he's a trooper. He let me put a mic in his face and ask him a whole bunch of questions for a while. And so he's got an amazing story. It's a story of a Jesus person going global, listening to that kind of nagging feeling that there's something he needs to be doing and needs to be about. And it's a story basically of somebody impacting the whole world as a result of that process. So what a story, Josh Brake. Let's get right to it now. Hear his story, hear how he started Katoa, and that moment that he had that started it all. But let's go way back, and let's wiki some God now with Josh Brake.
1979. I'm a 70s kid.
Me too. Right?
So
great.
It's great to get that extra
March?
Decade in there. September.
Oh, okay.
So born into a single parent family. My mom actually wasn't a Christian when she became pregnant with me.
Okay.
And then just through, you know, God's working, he brought a woman into her life that was a believer and was just really gracious with my mom. Explained the gospel to her and brought her to church. I think it was Queensway Cathedral at the time.
Oh.
And so
here, like in Toronto.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, my mom went to one of their services, received Christ, was actually, she was a chain smoker at the time, which isn't good when you're pregnant. And
wow.
She knew that, but she was kind of on the heavy side of a chain smoker.
Yeah.
And so, the pastor there just said, "Hey, if you need healing in some area of your life, you know, kind of come forward and we'll pray for you." So she did. And she never smoked again after that moment.
Wow.
Ever. Like, she never had a desire for it.
Huh.
So, you know, I would say that there was a story of healing in my mom's life,
yeah,
both spiritually and physically there.
And it ended up being very good news for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause that's not good to smoke when you're pregnant. It's not good to smoke at all. But, that being said, I was raised, by my mom. We lived in government housing in Toronto, and you don't know that you're poor until later in life. And
right, because it's just normal.
Everybody's poor.
Yeah.
I grew up, like, all of my friends. I was one of a few, very few white kids in my class, and the other white kids in my class were like from Bosnia and Serbia and Czechoslovakia at the time. You know, like. So it was a high immigrant community, Jamaicans, a lot of folks from different parts of Africa, you know, all over the place, Koreans, everybody.
This was your community.
This was my community. That's who I grew up with. Yeah. So Omar, Tafua, those were my friends. And everyone was in the same boat. So everyone I later realized was poor. Like, we just didn't have money.
Right.
We used our little money we had available to us to survive in different ways. Now, what we had that most others didn't in our community was that we had the church. So we started attending Rexdale Alliance Church, and they were, in almost every way imaginable, what the church should be to a young mom that isn't married, that, you know, that doesn't have means. And so for me growing up, a lot of my friends that I had at church, their dads were my dad. I mean, I'm still close with them. I'm still, you know, in many respects, I would still go to them for advice, counsel, confession, you know, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And the church also helped in different ways, be it with food or things like that at different mm-hmm. times. So the church was the church to us. So that really changed the environment that I grew up in. My mom also made really intentional decisions to work part-time so that she could be home. Mm. I lived in a dangerous or safe area, because it was, I never felt in danger, okay. but I certainly learned street smarts early on. Mm. Like, there are just places you don't go, or people you don't look in the eye, or, you know, you just get up the stairs and go home, like that kind of thing.
Right.
But police were around, there were shootings, things like that. Mm. We used to play this game. It's a very morbid game. So they used to, I don't know if they still even do this, they used to outline a body with chalk.
Yeah.
And so we'd walk home, and if there was a chalk outline on the way into the building, we used to, as kids, go around it and like try to push each other on top of the chalk line.
Oh.
And say, like, the ghost is going to get right. you, right? Yeah. Like, so we're kids, we're playing this game. Mm-hmm. It's a morbid game. But those are just some
That's
of the
not memory. Your typical yeah. environment. I've never even seen a chalk line.
Okay.
You're talking about multiple chalk lines where there's games involved.
Just, with kids.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
So, you know, we did that, those kinds of things. But looking back, so much of that upbringing shaped who I am today. Mm. And, you know, I started by saying I didn't know I was poor. I didn't really know I was poor until later, when you experience other parts of the world, you grow a little older. Mm. Realize that poverty in many ways is a relative thing.
Okay. I was going to say, do you not realize you're poor until somebody points it out to you? I'm sure that's...
Yeah, I mean, I lived in the buildings, but...
It's like you don't know your family's messed up until you see like one that's not quite...
or even more messed up than yours. Like,
messed up to some degree.
I thought I had it bad, but then look at them. No.
But it's just, when you're a kid, everything is normal. Nothing is, you know, it's just, this must happen in every house, or this must...
Well, and this is your reality. Yeah. I used to think for the longest time that everybody in church was rich because I had my running shoes and I had a pair of church shoes. Mm. And
shiny black leather ones.
I just assumed that everyone else lived in houses. Mm. They went to Disneyland. You know, that was my world, that was theirs. And I never thought I would enter into that world. Not that I mean, as a kid, you desire some of those things, but I never thought that they were achievable. I never thought I would travel anywhere. And now I've been to more than 30 countries and I've seen all parts of the world that the majority of the world will never see, just some of the places that I've gone. Mm. But those things, they help to shape you, and they help to provide humility in the midst of a greater context that you will encounter in life. So I'm grateful. As you know, as hard as some of those things were, I'm really grateful for those lessons now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So God provided all that we needed, really. Another organization.
And you're an only child? Sorry.
Only child.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's just you and your mom.
Just my mom and I. And
in the church. It's just awesome to hear a church, like you said, fulfilling the role that
you
read about.
And without any strings attached, as far as I never felt poor at church. Mm. I mean, I never felt that. I always felt not at all, ever, ever. And another organization that was really helpful to us was the Scott Mission growing up. We connected with them early on, and they helped quite a bit. And then I ended up working with them through their camp program, the Scott Mission Camp, for a number of years. And that was quite a formative time in my own life, too, just being able to work there as a kid, having gone there so often and loved it. It was 10 days a year of just absolute bliss for me.
Mm.
Just outside, there was no fear. You're just people that loved you. And
that's through the
amazing.
Scott Mission.
Through the Scott Mission. They still run their camp. It's in Caledon, actually. It's not far from here. So I still go up and visit on the summers.
Neat. So in your teens, like, are you hitting any kind of like, are you a kind of church guy? Kind of your typical evangelical DC talk spouting? What's the scene?
So I did grow up going to church. And so, that was always really formative for me. I had an early understanding of who God was, the gospel, Christ. I, as long as I can remember, would have called myself a Christian. Even though, you know, as a young person, you probably struggle with what that means or how to apply that in different ways. My mom actually married when I was 10 to a man that she met at our church. And so for all intents and purposes, he was my dad.
Right.
I still called him Robert.
Even though you had several men that felt like that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And so I called him Robert, and he was cool with that. But he adopted me, so legally I was his son. Oh. And but then he died when I was 16.
Oh, no.
So just really, really suddenly had a blood clot in his lung, and that was it. So kind of at a season where I was probably needing my dad the most, and not having had a dad for so long, he was just taken immediately, quick.
Mm-hmm.
So that changes a lot for you. I was in high school. I was in grade 11 at the time. And I was a guy that knew how to work the system, so I maximized my spares.
Mm.
You could have 10 spares in high school at the time when I was there.
So like
I took
huge
all 10.
Blocks of free
oh,
time.
Yeah. Like, I'm off every afternoon, every other day at school. But what I did is I worked. So at one point, I was working 3 different jobs and then running my own leaf and snow removal company with a friend.
Wow.
So I just figured it was a time that I needed to work hard and save well so that I could go to school and do whatever else it is I wanted to do.
Mm.
So, you know, I grew up probably more, well, not probably, I was more interested in sports and girls than I was in the gospel at the time. And I'm grateful that through influences both in Toronto and then later when I moved to Ottawa, helped to shift that focus back to the gospel and make that, you know, the preeminent focus of my life.
Okay. So what took you to Ottawa? Was it Ottawa U?
So I went to Carleton University. My wife went to Ottawa U.
Oh.
So we are star-crossed lovers.
How come I read in a bio you went to Ottawa U?
I don't know. People write anything they want about me. I'm also 6'4".
In certain bio?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So I went there with the intention of studying criminology and doing a degree in criminology and sociology. I joined the Toronto Scottish Regiment in my last year of high school and did basic training with them and did some exercises and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Served during the ice storm, the great ice storm of 98.
Yeah.
So I went to school to really become a police officer. That's what I wanted to do.
Oh, okay.
Long-term goal was I wanted to be a sniper.
Oh.
Yeah, scary.
Well, there's a movie out right
now. Yeah. So
makes that maybe less desirable.
I got there and did 3 years of school, began attending the Metropolitan Bible Church in my second year of school.
Mm.
Really decided after my first year that I needed to not partially be a Christian. Mm. I needed to be all in on this.
Mm.
So I made the decision in my second year to find an apartment that was one bus to church. And in Ottawa, it's cold.
Yeah.
It's like freeze your eyelashes together cold if you blink too long.
I'm an Ottawa boy.
And Sunday mornings, there's not a lot of bus service. So I said, okay, I'm going to be right on Bank Street. Yeah. Took me right downtown, right to the Met. Jumped off, started going to church there, and then heard this preaching, which was just, I'm opening my Bible and I'm following what they're saying.
Mm.
And I'm learning from it. And it's changing, you know, it's changing my heart.
Yeah.
You know, as I'm hearing these things, I'm thinking, oh, I knew the gospel, and I would have identified as a Christian, but there were parts of my life and parts of my heart that just had not been impacted by it, and I think I had not given over to God. So,
was this your first exposure to kind of expository or systematic?
Probably in a way where I was intentionally listening.
Yeah, there's
I
that
would
other
say
half
others, of, yeah. others probably attempted, and so I don't want to slight their attempts because I refused to listen. So,
but you were thinking about girls and sports while that was going.
Yeah, and so now all of a sudden I'm interested in reading my Bible. So I had this little Bible that the Scott Mission gave me as a camper, and I had it in my, because you're always wearing a winter coat in Ottawa, I had it in my big winter coat, and I had a lot of time on OC Transpo.
Right.
So that I would spend an hour a day just reading this little New Testament.
Mm.
Until it was tattered.
Did you have any like interactions with people? You got a bus whipped out, you're reading it?
No, it was just kind of a neat time in my life. It was I would say it was a sweet season where I was just being poured into by the word.
Nice.
And I was attending the Met, and I would help out on Wednesday mornings. They had this like women's Bible study thing, but they'd pay students to come and take care of kids.
Mm.
So I'm like, $10 an hour to take care of kids? Yeah. Sure, this is great. So I do that. And then I'd have lunch with one of the pastors that was there, I'd bring my lunch and we'd sit down and talk. I had a lot of questions about what I was reading and I was really digging in. And so we'd sit, his name is Godfrey Thorogood, and just a really great friend of mine still to this day. And it got to the point where I knew something else was happening. Something else was going on other than taking care of kids and talking about what does this passage really mean? I'm confused about this. How can this be this if this is this? You know, that kind of stuff. And I went in to tell him that I felt like something else needed to happen. Like maybe I should go to school or... And I should learn more about my Bible in a more...
You're in what, second, third year?
I'm in my third year by that point. And so the Wednesday I go and I tell him this, he says, well, Josh, I was actually going to ask you today if you'd consider being our very first intern at the church. So I think back on it now and it's such a strange thing to do. But in kind of a unique way, it was my way of just putting down my net and following Christ. And so I finished out my degrees.
So it was a strange thing for you to do, to agree to become an intern?
It was the easiest decision I've ever made, probably. Like it was just so
even
natural.
Though it
like,
kind of threw things off track a little bit? Or did
I didn't even think of it.
It
was like, okay, well, I'm going to finish my degrees and then I'm going to start working at the church.
Okay.
Well, you know, so it's, who does that? I don't know. Like that's why I just feel like God was doing a work in my heart. You know, the Holy Spirit was prompting both the church and myself at that time and all sorts of things. So... But it is a strange career choice, given that I'd been doing everything else to set up for a career in policing, and then just to say, okay, well, I guess I'm going to be an intern at the church, making you know minimum wage,
right?
You know, being an intern, you know, like learning stuff.
It's the vocational version of like, come follow me, and they just got up and left.
Sort of. Now they gave me a year buffer on that, so they said, well, finish out your degree. Like that's wise. You've invested in this, so I did that. The church was setting up some things, so. Got that done. And then once I was there, I was at the church during a time of just incredible growth. And growth, I would say, not just numerical, though it was numerical. You know, the church grew to almost 2,000 people during that time. It was about 1,000 when I got there. And I was only there 2.5 years. So for a church to grow that quickly.
Do you remember what year that was?
Yeah, that like would have been 2001, 2002, 2002 to
That's
2004.
Right when I was going to Ottawa U as well.
Yeah.
And I'd been hearing about this church, and I think people were talking about it because of the like uncontrolled, wild growth happening there. It was just kind of the buzz of the...
You know, our young adult group there, which drew from Algonquin and Carleton and Ottawa U and stuff like that, it wouldn't be uncommon to have 300 people out on a Thursday night, which is larger than most churches. Right. And so I got my experience in teaching in an environment like that, where you're having a lot of interaction. There's a lot of people coming
like
that are
challenging,
are
ideas.
Searching.
Yeah.
It's not as much of a controlled Sunday morning environment. You have people that are coming that aren't afraid to question things and ask you hard questions and that want to learn, that are going to push you on, well, this is, what does the word say about this? Or I don't know if I can follow that. Is this what Christ is calling me to follow? And then engaging in that in that conversation. So I did that for 2.5 years. Met my wife at the Met. We met at the Met.
Okay.
And and then we got married and moved to Spain 10 days later. And that's where I worked at Cape and Ray Bible School in Alicante.
Wow.
And so we were newlyweds with a house of 14 boys, 14 teenage sons.
So they're like
they
in
lived
your
in our
care.
Yeah, okay. Under my care. And my wife was actually a student at the school. So,
but is she living in the house with 15
there was
males?
Two. Yeah, we had, so it was so funny. She'd get up in the morning, like we'd get breakfast routines ready and, you know, there'd be 10 or 12 guys sitting at the table. Hey, Bar, how you doing? You know, she'd come out and it was really fun. So it was a neat season in our life to do that.
Yeah,
and cool. A good growth period. So we came back. I finished up some schooling that I was doing.
Was that your first trip? Because I kind of wanted to ask you about
it. Yes, it was.
Like you're kind of this jet setter because of your...
I never thought
Spain
I'd go anywhere.
Your first
ever.
Overseas.
Yeah, okay. we did that. We flew to Spain and lived there and kind of traveled around a little bit. But it really hit me after when we traveled around Mediterranean Europe for a bit. We took an overnight train from Madrid to Paris. And I get out in Paris and we're just by the Louvre. And I'm looking around and I've never seen anything like this. And we're sitting there and I start to cry. Wow. I'm standing there with my mom. She's like, what's wrong? And I said, like, I'm tearing up right now. Mm. I said, I never thought I would see anything like this ever in my life.
Right.
Like never did I thought to think I would be here. Mm. And just to see that, I felt so privileged. I felt so, like, look at this beauty. Mm-hmm. It's so amazing. Mm. And so we traveled around and got to do a lot of that together. It was fairly sanitized in the sense that, you know, we were going to all the tourist spots and things like that. But we were newly married and living on nothing. So it was fun trying to figure out ways to, you know, you get a second chocolate bar out of a vending machine one time. You're like, yes. It's like you just won the lottery.
That's a shoestring. Yeah. Is that in The Lonely Planet? This machine, if you shake it a certain
way. I'm telling you. Yeah, when you find yourself lost by a train station and you have €1 left and you get two things.
Right.
God just provided.
Nice. So how long were you at Cave and Rain? Did you say?
About 3 months,
okay.
4 months.
Okay.
And then we traveled around for a bit, came back, actually lived with Barb's parents for 4 months. Mm. And then we moved to Thailand where we lived in Bangkok. My wife had a work exchange program that she was on there. And I ended up working for, it was OMF that was over there. Overseas Missionary Fellowship. I just said, hey, I'm coming. I got nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Let me volunteer for you. So I was stapling, stacking chairs, doing that kind of stuff. And then I met a guy that was there doing some teaching on Buddhism for the missionaries. Began talking to him and kind of had a bit of a Goodwill Hunting experience where he said, so what are you doing here? So I'm just stacking chairs. And he said, do you want to work at a university? I said, okay. Literally just like that. He said, well, my flight leaves in an hour. We need to leave now. So I said, okay. So we got in a taxi. We went down to the university, which is for Buddhist monks in the area. It's right next to the Grand Palace, this spectacular place. He introduced me to the head monk and the head nun. They said, this is my friend Joshua. This is what he'll do for you. This is how much you'll pay him. And this is when he'll start. Is that acceptable? And he said, yes. And he looked at me and he said, you start tomorrow. And I said, okay. So I had no idea what I was doing or anything, but I was a Christian working there, which was my heart, to be in a place that conceptually doesn't know grace, doesn't understand grace. It just doesn't exist.
Mm.
So to be able to sit down and have what was eventually entitled monk chat every day at these tables with these monks that were doing their studies, I think was formative for me because I'm speaking to people about the gospel that have no concept of the gospel. Mm. They know about Jesus, but they don't know the gospel.
Mm-hmm. And you were conversely learning about Buddhism.
Like, yeah. So what I would do is I would actually, on my way there each day, I would read my teachings of the Buddha on this horrible, horrible bus ride that I had there where you're just sick with the you know, pollution. But I would read the teachings of the Buddha on the way there, and then I would read my Bible on the way home. Mm. And I found, you know, heading in there, I had answers in my head, but I wasn't wanting to go in as if I was ready for combat or something. Right. I really wanted to go in and saying, hey, this is what I read from your sacred writings.
For sure.
And of course, so many things that that are ascribed to the Buddha are very similar, ethically speaking, to teachings in Christianity. But they're so close, but they're just so far away. Like they're close, but not quite there, you know, as far as what the heart of salvation is and the heart of God for man that has fallen and that needs a savior.
Mm.
So I would get to learn things about what they were doing and then go in, discuss, edit their master's thesis that were written in English, which was a challenge.
And that was your actual job?
That was
job
my actual
there?
Job okay. was to engage. So, but then they had all kinds of questions. They had to take world religion classes. And so they would study Christianity, but it'd be taught by a Buddhist monk. So they would come and they would ask these questions and thankfully I had answers.
Right.
You know? So I would
cross reference with you.
Yeah. So we would, you know, we always knew that the conversation came to a close when there were no other questions we could ask.
Hmm.
So one of the ones that was most memorable for me was, talking to them about their search for nothingness.
Yeah.
And I said, so when you're searching for nothingness, how do you know when you found it?
Hmm.
And the question just hung, and then we were done. And that was, it was a fairly profound moment in our conversations. I'm sure everyone's had profound conversations with people when you feel like something significant just happened.
Yeah.
And that was one of them. So our,
even when you said, can you unpack a little bit about no conception of grace? Do you just mean in terms of the free gift of, like not having to religiously work through something?
Yeah. Okay. Everything's based on merit. Okay. Like when my wife and I were there, we took this, you know, weekend vacation to one of the islands. We got a bus, great time. On our way back, our bus hit a motorcycle and, we know at least killed one man and not another. One another was really injured. And my wife saw us hit the couple in the bus stop. And everyone was sitting there and I just jumped up and ran off the bus. Like, we got to try to help these people. And we did everything we could, including pray.
Yeah.
And one of the men died. And it was really hard for us. And as we were telling the story to the people in the, as I was telling the story to the head nun, she said, well, you will get much merit for this. You will get much merit for what you have done. And that's really the hamster wheel that is inherent with Buddhism.
Okay.
Is this merit. I can earn what I need to achieve this state. And I can escape the cycle.
That must have been like, you must have heard that idea and been kind of what? Like, I'm trying to think, do we talk like that as Christians?
We don't talk like that as Christians, but I think sometimes we act like that as Christians. We do, certainly. And
so God will bless you. But still, fundamentally, we still say, oh, yeah, but salvation is a gift. I don't know.
Yeah. I would say that it's not a conscious struggle, but it's something I'm consciously aware of as I work through Katoa. Like, here's a lot of good stuff. We're doing a lot of good things. We're helping people, people that are created in the image of God. That's a good thing to do. And there can be a lot of praise heaped on me or towards our organization where I can think, wow, I'm so great. But in the end, salvifically speaking, we bring nothing to the table when it comes to our salvation. Like, we are empty. We are broken. We are beggars of the worst degree, right? We are criminals. And so there aren't a million Katoas that I could start or a million lives that I could save through feeding programs or something like that that would in some way warrant my salvation. So there's a fundamental difference that we encountered. Well, ethically and morally speaking, there were a lot of things that we would agree on, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. When it came to how are you saved, we're on different pages and we're not going in the same direction. So all roads do not lead to Rome. You know, when we're talking about salvation.
Wow. We could talk all day about, maybe that's another podcast about the differences between what you've learned, Buddhism and Christianity. And talk a little bit about, so you get your MTS at Heritage.
Yep.
When did that come in?
So I started that while I was working at the Met.
Okay.
I was working on it part-time. So I was working at the Met full-time and then doing studies part-time and then That was kind of the life, life of an intern.
Yep.
And I grew a lot, learned a lot through that experience, and then carried that on until really almost I started here at Maple Avenue Baptist Church here in Georgetown 8 years ago, 8.5 years ago now. Yeah. Wow. So
yeah,
I finished just before I came here.
So how did you land here?
How did we land here?
Job opening, or was it that story that you've been telling where somebody looks at you and says, here's what's next for you?
Yeah, exactly.
That seems to be a pattern.
Yeah, well, I knew at the time that I wasn't ready to be a senior pastor. I didn't have that kind of experience. I didn't feel that would be wise. I had certain aspirations towards that maybe at some point, but I didn't want to be a youth pastor. Not because it's not important, but because all the youth pastor positions that were put before me seemed to be the, you know, do this for a while, get good at what you do.
Right, it's a stepping stone.
A stepping stone. I thought, no, this is a pastoral calling.
Right.
Someone needs to have a heart for youth. You need to shepherd the church. You know, that's not where my heart is. So I don't want to be functioning in that way. So I was 25 and looking for an associate pastor position, which is hard to get.
Yeah. I was doing that at 32. I was told I was too young several times.
So I ended up...
You only have an MDiv and you're only in your early 30s. Who do you think you
What's
are?
What's wrong with you? Like, they slap you, go get your PhD.
Well, times have changed because, like, you know, some of my mentors are in their 50s. They're like, their first lead pastor charge is when they were like 24 or something. You're just like, wow, times have changed. I mean, it's good that there's kind of due diligence. But
So I was working with the Associated Gospel Churches of Canada at the time, which the Met was a part of, but they weren't didn't seem to be lining up as far as a job was concerned.
Okay.
So I allowed my name to be floated in other circles and ended up being referred to this church. I didn't even know where Georgetown was at the time. Came up here, met with the senior pastor that was here at the time, really appreciated his heart for wanting to reach the community. And then I started doing the math about how many people attended churches that professed the gospel, that taught the Bible in Georgetown, as opposed to the number of people that lived in Georgetown, and felt like this was a place, while on many levels has such such sheen to it. It's a fairly high net worth community, lots of great resources here. People are very kind. It's a safe community. There's just a lot of people that need the gospel as well. So I felt that this would be a good place to come. My wife agreed. We came up incognito, you know, wore our fake mustaches.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. novelty cowboy hats.
Yeah.
and felt like, yeah, this is a place where God could use us.
Okay.
And that's been the journey we've been on for 8 years now. Yeah.
I read that you kind of said, again, one of these bios that may or may not be true now. My confidence is rocked. You aim to live missional lives among the people of Georgetown. So when you and your wife and kids land here and you've been here for 8 years, what does that look like, missional lives? Because it's typically hard for pastors to get out of the bubble. And, you know, I've heard Hugh Halter say really well, pastors are often kind of on the bench. Like, that's the way they need to be seen in a lot of circles. Like, the people who come on Sunday or whatever, they're actually out on the ice, to use a hockey analogy.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But the pastors are benched, like they're behind the bench.
Right.
So how are you finding you can live a missional?
Well, first of all, I think living missionally is intentional, regardless of your position in a local church. But I would say, just as a precursor to that, I never feel that I need to apologize or that we need to apologize for pastors who take very seriously their role, their specific role at equipping the saints for works of service. Right? They have a God-ordained task at shepherding the local church. So we never want to be hard on somebody for actually doing that well. What that is going to mean, it's going to mean that they have less time to be able to invest in other people, other avenues of relationship, other missional ways. That being said, they are not excused from also living in the way that other Christians are called to live. Right? And so if we are all to be ambassadors of Christ, I mean, that is a wonderful analogy that has gripped my heart in so many ways. To be an ambassador is to live amongst a people that are not your own on behalf of someone else. So, you know, scripture says that we are aliens in this world. You know, Christians, we're the aliens, we're the weird ones.
Yeah.
And we are called to live amongst the people that are not our own, in the sense that others who do not profess Christ obviously do not share our family heritage, and that we would say, you know, we are sons and daughters of the Most High God. We are co-heirs with Christ. That's totally different than someone who just says, oh, I think Jesus was a good guy. You know, I'm not so sure I'm cool with Merry Christmas, but, you know, I'm sure he's all right, you know, like that kind of thing. So we have made a very intentional decision to know our neighbors. Who are your neighbors? Who do you live next to? Who do your kids go to school with? What are their stories? What is their background? How are they thinking about God generally, Christ specifically, and their own salvation? Are they working towards something? Do they even know the gospel? What I found is that in most communities and people that I've engaged with, people just don't know the message.
Right.
And that is very, I know it's very different. I'm not one of these people that says, well, you know, if it was only 50 years ago, well, it's not 50 years ago, it's now. And the reality is when I go into a school and I talk about Katoa and I talk about, you know, the parable of the Good Samaritan, because you're still allowed to use Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. And it's an easy way to talk about my faith. Mm-hmm. People don't know that where that came from. Mm. Did you know that that is a parable that Jesus told?
Right.
Here's what it means. And here's how it's actually reflective of our own hearts and our own need. And here's what Christ did for us. Mm-hmm. You know, so I just feel like there's a lot of people that just don't know the message and they haven't had a chance, though through their lives they've said no, they haven't actually said no to the gospel because right. they actually haven't heard the gospel right. yet. Mm-hmm. They haven't, you know, everyone rejects the gospel, but in a unique way, they haven't rejected the gospel because they haven't heard it.
Right.
And so my heart still for this community is that people would have an opportunity to hear the gospel and respond to it. Mm. You know, take away all the trappings, the cultural trappings that sometimes come with that, and honestly engage the gospel. What does it mean for your life? That's a hard thing.
Well,
we can't rush
that. It's intentional. Like the things you described about mm-hmm. getting to know your neighbors, and that's a very intentional thing.
You know, we have a Christmas party and we invite 100 houses mm-hmm. And see who comes. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we have 10 people in our living room. Maybe there's 300 people coming in and out all night. Mm. And, you know, we don't know even who some of them were. Mm. But our kids are definitely, you know, as parents, our children are our primary responsibility when it comes to messaging the gospel, like here, displaying the gospel in our own lives and then communicating it to them. Mm. But then also, how are they then living out the gospel? Mm. You know, they're just coming to grips with some of these things. And at an early age, they, our oldest understands what it means to follow Jesus. Mm. And why doesn't everyone do that? Mm. You know, so we feel like our kids as well are a great opportunity for us to be able to talk to others and just allow our lives to be a display of changed hearts. Yeah. We do things in a way that the world does not do things. Mm. That's what Christians should do. That's the way the church is supposed to operate. Mm-hmm. So when there's conflict, do we turn our backs and start chucking stones? Or do we extend forgiveness and humbly apologize?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's, they're different. It's a different world. So we're bringing essentially a Christian culture and not a, I don't want to say like a colonialized Christianity, mm-hmm. but a Christian culture in the way the Bible talks about it.
Bringing healing, bringing
to our community. Yeah. And how do people see that? And then how can they engage with that? Mm. That's really important to us. Mm. My wife's amazing at that. You know, I have it easy because I have a job mm-hmm. that's at a church.
Right.
So I have a bit of a gimme on some things.
Yeah.
But my wife's amazing at that. She meets moms all the time. She's just so gracious with people and helping them, and she's very kind. So nice. I'm lucky to have her.
Yeah. In the last few minutes, the reason I'm here,
yeah.
40 minutes later, the story of Katoa coming yeah. into being. And,
right.
And I'm excited for you to explain how it works, because I went through and signed yeah. up. It's really unique to actually go through the process of signing up. But what was the bolt of lightning
right.
moment? Because was it like that? Did it work like that? Kind of
yeah, there was
eureka?
There was an aha moment, uh-huh. I think. so I was volunteering with an organization called Partners International at the time. We were doing a monitoring trip where I went over to some tribal parts of India and other Taliban-controlled areas of Pakistan, hmm. which were very dangerous. And we were in and we were seeing these brick kilns where generations of families were present and they were slaves. Hmm. And so we got in when the guards weren't there and we took pictures and did video and wrote reports and all sorts of things and brought those back to the appropriate people.
Is this kind of supported by the caste system? in that sense, you just say like generations of...
No, it's supported by an illegal system of indentured servitude, as they would call it. Mm. People that owe money and then are charged money to live at the place where they work, more money than they make. Mm. And then they're not freed. And then any children they have are into that system as well. And then their children. And so it continues and continues. Mm. So it's quite a it's a problem, a big problem that's plaguing our world right now, both human trafficking and the modern slave trade.
Yeah.
Is massive.
Which is explained away in ways that you just described.
Well, right.
It's not
well,
slavery,
it's not this. It's yeah. And except try to leave and then they'll kill your right. family.
How were you allowed to walk around taking
well,
pictures?
Well, we weren't.
In there? Okay.
So I was dressed up in, you know, kind of a Muslim garb.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't really blend
in. In the back of a van with, you know, curtains. Mm. And they said, here's a great story. We're getting up to go in the morning. And the guy who's with us, he grabs my hand and he looks at me and he says, Brother Josh, if they should take you, just keep saying, I love Pakistan.
Mm.
Okay, let's go. Just like this. And then he throws me like a roll of toilet paper to be like, oh, you might need this. Like,
wow.
You know, and then we go and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I have two kids at home.
Yeah.
Like this just got real.
Yeah.
You know, this just got real. And as I met the Christians that were in Pakistan, I thought, they asked me to preach at one of their secret church gatherings. Mm. And I'm thinking, what on earth am I doing preaching here? Like, you guys just keep sharing. I'm being ministered to here. Mm-hmm. Like, I shouldn't be speaking at all.
Mm.
And just hearing kind of what Christians grow through and other minorities yeah. in Pakistan, it's a very difficult situation.
Mm.
So we got to go in, again, through a Christian network that's there, and see these things. You know, after I left there, I went to some tribal parts of India and saw the work that was being done there, as well as a home for girls that had been saved from brothels.
Mm.
And I say girls, like young girls. It's a horrible, horrible thing to contemplate. And as I was leaving there, we were in a vehicle going back to where we were staying. And at the time, there was 1.1 billion people in India. And I thought, that 0.1 is three times the population of Canada. Just that 0.1. This is a massive population. Mm-hmm. And I was doing math in rupees at that time. So I was like, well, you know, this 50 rupees is about $1. What can you buy for 50 rupees here? I knew how much great work could be done for so little.
Mm.
So I thought, what if? And then you start asking that what if. And that what if that night, as I couldn't sleep and as I was just reading through my Bible, just grew into this idea. So I was committed in my brain that if when I got home, if someone else was already doing this, someone was already doing what was to be known as Katoa one day,
yeah.
I would support them.
Right.
Great job. I'm with you. If they weren't, I would float the idea to my wife that maybe we should do that.
Mm.
And I knew that wouldn't be an easy sell because I'm the kind of a guy that has a lot of ideas. Like,
so it looked like just one of many.
Yeah, you know, I tried to think like, okay, all right. Well, how about we go be sheep farmers in New Zealand?
Okay.
You know, like just... Why not?
So it was more, how do I tell her I'm really serious?
I'm really, really serious about this one. No, not like the last one I was really serious about, but this one I'm really serious yeah. about. So I told her the idea and then I left it. I didn't push because in the past I would, you know, I'd try to just keep talking about it until she'd throw something in my direction. No, she never throws anything at me much anymore. So
through common sense in
yeah. So I left it and then a couple weeks later, I was still kind of bringing it up every now and then, but not in a forceful way because I thought it's probably not going to happen.
So she what said, was the idea? Maybe not, oh, not the pitch, so, but
yeah,
like,
the idea
what
was,
did you tell her?
What if we got as many people from all around the world to give $1 a month to a pot?
Hmm.
And then every month, however many people gave $1, we would decide where that money went.
Mm.
But we'd give them some way to do that, some voice into the process. Mm-hmm. And like technologically speaking, we were at the perfect point in human history to make that happen.
Mm.
The internet was there. Online credit was there. You know, we use credit cards and PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how we've used money. So scalability is there. Everything is there that we need to mm-hmm. exist virtually. But make an actual impact in the world.
Yep.
So she came back and said, I think this could actually work. And then I said, but it's going to mean us giving our savings to start this. You know, there's lawyer fees. There's all kinds of things that you got to do. You got to build a website that I found out was going to cost over $100,000 to build at its base.
What?
Yeah. So I said, well, we didn't have that kind of money. So we just started through different networks of people, ended up finding people that are on board with us that are willing to work hard for much less than they would normally make and create a website that is excellent and very beautiful. Unique in its field.
Yeah.
There is no one else. There are no other charities doing exactly what we're doing.
Wow.
And so we just finished up a season of consultation with Deloitte. Mm. We were really blessed to get some time with them. And they couldn't find anyone that did what we did. Mm. So when they were looking for comparisons, they're, you guys are, right. Wow, this is going to be a challenge. Like, you yeah. guys are unique. Yeah. How do we tell you to become somebody else when there's no one else like you? So Barb was on board, which was really important. And then we spent the next year and a half just figuring out, how do we actually make this work? How do we build a site? How do we start to test things? Mm. We started from scratch. I have no experience in doing this.
Wow.
So I also dropped down to half-time at church.
Mm.
So my really large associate pastor salary went down to about half, right. Well, almost half. Huh. And then I worked the rest of my time on Katoa, making wow. that happen. And eventually we started getting critical mass and people telling people and things like that. So,
but there must have been that period of financial contraction where you're just like, wow.
All we're doing is spending money, folks.
It's all going out.
Yeah. We understood that this could fail.
Mm-hmm.
We still understand it could fail. It could. Sure. Mm. And if that's the case, then the money that we've invested and other people have invested is lost. And that's part of being entrepreneurial.
Mm.
Yep. But we don't believe that'll be the case, and things are happening that we believe are showing just the opposite's going to be the case. We're right. growing really fast.
Right. So can you explain a bit? I mean, you talked about the idea functionally.
Yep.
What happens now if somebody, I mean, so my experience, I did it a couple of days ago. Like you said, I was surprised that that's all Katoa asked for.
Yeah.
I was like, I clicked on it and I thought there'd be an option. Like, you can give a dollar, but that's really sad.
No.
Why don't you give a little, like give 10 bucks? There was no, it was like, I clicked a button and it was like, thank you very much. That's exactly what we asked of you. I was like, wow, that was, and then the voting.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Can you tell us what people
it's a principle based decision. We want it's this: one person, $1, one vote. Mm. So, if you're using Katoa and you're in Canada, or you are using Katoa and you're in Kolkata or in Tokyo, we want you to have the same experience. Mm. We also want it to be equally available. So if you have an internet connection and a credit card or a PayPal account, you can afford to be a part of Katoa.
Mm-hmm.
So we have kids that are a part of Katoa. We have adults with six-figure salaries that are a part of Katoa, and they have the exact same voice.
Hmm.
That's it. You know, everyone has the same voice.
Well, and that voice is borne out through voting, which, again, like you said, even on a kid's level, after I gave my dollar, I was presented with three possible places the money would go.
That's right.
And a really nice article description of what the need was, and it was just a sense of ownership.
Exactly. And then we ask people to share. So each month we have a different humanitarian theme. We change our humanitarian theme each month because we know that people's attention span is really small. It's really low. So we want to switch things up. One month it will be women's health. Another month it might be housing. For example, this month we're doing housing with Habitat for Humanity. Another month it might be child soldiers.
Habitat sites.
That's right. Okay. So Habitat will give us three projects. Mm. So our partner always wins. Mm-hmm. We never pit partners against each other because that would be a waste of their time.
Right.
We don't want to do that. So they give us three projects and we promote those and we say, hey, everyone who's given a dollar, you get a vote. Which project do you think should get all the money?
Mm.
The project with the most votes gets all the money at the end of the month.
Okay.
And so when you share...
So mine only got 36%.
Well, hey, you want to give it a boost. So what you got to do is you got to share it on Facebook or Twitter or email it to some friends.
But again, it was three great options. It's not like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. No, we support good things. So in some sense, it's hard for people because they're saying, these are three really good things.
Mm-hmm.
What do we support? On the other hand, we're saying, well, everything's going to win and we're bringing light to three really good projects that this organization supports.
I like that educational piece.
The other thing that we try to do, which is our really big win, is we want to be a mouthpiece for these organizations.
Mm.
So we don't charge them anything, or we give them a free service, essentially.
Right.
So if you were to come across the Child Soldier Initiative, the Romeo Dallaire Child Soldier Initiative, and you didn't know that there's, you know, a quarter million child soldiers in the world, and 40% of those are girls, for whom their life is horrible. All of a sudden, you come across this, and you've given a dollar for the first time in your life to the prevention of this horrible, horrible issue. Then you say, but you know what? I've got a little extra. Maybe I'm going to give 10 bucks to them, or I'm going to give $100 to them. I spoke at a school, and one of the kids emailed me later, and he said that he had been given $20 for his birthday, and he was giving that $20 to the Child Soldier Initiative. And for me, I'm thinking, this is the ultimate win. We have no way of quantifying that. We don't know.
Right. So that awareness for him was sparked through Katoa, you're saying?
Yeah. Like the dollar led to... So we're changing people's perspectives on, first of all, education, but then they're actually doing something. They're actually giving a dollar. So at some point, when we have enough people, maybe we're going to have enough to build a hospital in rural India where there's, you know, 2 million people and no hospitals. Can I build a hospital on my own? No, but I can give a dollar towards it. And so can, I don't know, 100,000 other people, a billion other people. The more people we get giving a dollar, just the bigger things we're going to be able to do.
Yeah.
And that's what excites me and excites the people that are involved.
Yeah.
So you share it on Facebook or Twitter, somebody clicks on your link, and then we automatically tag them to you. So it's a bit of a family tree. So you can see how, you know, you've been involved for a month. So you've given a buck. So you've given a dollar, but 10 other people have joined. So really $11 has been given because of you. We can track all that stuff. And so it's neat to see how it spreads out over the world.
Right. Because you get a...
Which it has. We have people in, you know, a couple dozen countries now that are actively involved in Katoa.
Wow.
You know, I don't know anybody in, where's that? In Monaco, for example. I don't know anyone that lives in Monaco, but we have a Katoa member that's actively giving in Monaco.
Wow.
So it spreads, right? Yeah. Somebody tells somebody, tells somebody.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
The value behind Katoa, I've read, is, it's based on the reality. This is a quote, that people everywhere are equally important, equally valuable, and hold the same potential. What's significant about that quote kind of representing the organization?
Well, on two levels, there's a personal gospel-driven reality to that statement. It's born out in loving God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then the second part of that, which is loving your neighbor as yourself, knowing that each person has been created in the image of God. There is an inherent value in every single person. And we do our worship of God a disservice when we refuse aid to those who need it, who have been created in the image of God. So when a man is drowning in the river, the first thing as I come across him that I don't ask is, what God do you worship? Who do you love? What kind of job do you have? What color is your skin? What language do you speak?
Are you a good person or a bad person?
I don't ask any of those things. I extend my hand and I pull them out of the river. I think that would be a good action for anyone to take. As a Christian, I think it's a required action to take. Then beyond that, I say, here's my life, and whatever circumstance allows, that's where I become an ambassador for Christ. So, you know, we had this ice storm that hit Georgetown like crazy last year. We had trees falling down on people's houses. If a tree falls down on the house next to us, the first thing we're not doing is going over and asking them if they know the gospel of Jesus Christ and would they like to come to our worship service. You know what we're doing is we're getting some guys and we're saying, let's get this tree off the guy's roof. He's our neighbor. In a very real sense, he's our neighbor. Let's get the tree off his roof. And let's extend Christian hospitality to him in whatever way we can. Some of that comes through practical means, but also we don't need to be afraid or ashamed of saying there is a message of the gospel in which salvation is found. And that's also important. So you find winsome ways and honest ways to say that aren't manipulative or that don't curb the truth of the gospel, or maybe sand down some of the rough edges of the gospel, because the gospel's exclusionary in its actual entity, right? It's saying that not everyone believes Christ, not everyone is a follower of Jesus. And so it's being honest with our explanation of that amidst whatever turmoil is going on.
Right.
And so what we want to do in Katoa is let people everywhere help people everywhere, because people everywhere matter. So you might be living in a country where we have a project. That's fine. You're giving, and you're someone in your country might benefit from that. But you might be giving to someone in some other part of the world, and they are no less valuable. So, you know, there's a lot of horrible things going on in the world right now. The thing that always concern, well, there's a number of things that concern me, but one of them is the kind of media attention that's given to them.
The selective media?
I mean, you talk about how horrible all of these things are, but if you look at the scale of what's going on, there are certain things in certain parts of the world right now that are happening on a horrific, unthinkable scale that is just not being given any attention, whether it's for geopolitical means, or there's not the salaciousness of media there or something like that. It's troubling. But at our level, we want to say everyone matters. Everyone's equally important. So hopefully we begin to change people's hearts by that too.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot. We, for the sake of time in the podcast, and I know we really stretched you with your cold. So thanks so much for hanging in so much. How can listeners engage Katoa right now when this podcast is done?
Now. I mean, you're still listening to this. You can just open up another browser window.
There you go.
And go to katoa.org, KUTOA.org, and create your account, sign up, and then share it with friends. Share it on Facebook, share it on Twitter, email it to everyone you know. That's how this grows. You'll grow your impact, and we'll help a lot of people in the process.
Yeah, I did it within 5 minutes from doing what you described, KUTOA.org, and then within 5 minutes, I was voting.
Awesome.
It's just a great interface, and I'm
and
excited.
The great thing is you only have to do it once. You don't even have to pay each month. We just do it automatically off your PayPal or credit card. Yeah. So you have to remember, we'll send you an email to remind you.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge hassle.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thanks for this.
Thanks so much, Josh. Appreciate it.
Awesome.
Okay. Oh, wow. Well, there you go. Josh Brake. Now you know about Josh. Now you know about Katoa.org. Now get yourself over to the website. Do the dollar a month thing. It's easy. It's fun to vote on the projects. The one that I always seem to vote for never gets voted for. I don't know what that says about me. But hey, even when you lose on a vote like that, there's still some awesome stuff happening with my dollar. So it's really fun to vote, to see what your dollar a month is doing, and it's making real change in the world. Katoa.org. And now make sure you subscribe to WikiGod on Faith Strong Today so you never miss an uncut episode of the show. To connect with me, email me at mark@wikigodpod.com or tweet me at markrollo or at wikigodpod on Twitter. I would love to hear your feedback, your thoughts about anything you're hearing here. And now, join us again right here on Faith Strong Today next week when we are wikiing God with Dr. Wendy Vanderwall Gritter. She's executive director of New Direction, New Direction Ministries, and she's the author of the book Generous Spaciousness, Responding to Gay Christians in the Church. Oh, it's a humdinger. It's a doozy. You do not want to miss that full conversation. So we'll see you next week for that. In the meantime, thanks for wikiing. See you then.
Thanks for listening to WikiGod, presented by Faith Strong Today. Share this episode on social media and find more great programs at faithstrongtoday.com.